So you ready for a little science experiment?
Yeah!
Okay, so we're gonna need a few things. Your notebook and a pencil.
Got it.
Sandwich baggies.
Got it.
Big black Sharpie marker.
Got it.
Tape. Gotta find some tape. And finally, the last thing we're gonna need is bread.
Bread.
Go grab the bread. So we are gonna grow a friend.
I don't think mold's a friend.
Hey there, everybody. This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today, producers Taylor Quimby and Erica Janik are here to present another edition in our series, Inside In, short science stories for families and individuals who want to discover how, even when they're stuck inside, the natural world ties us together. Today, they're going to teach us to appreciate a pair of organisms that we often just step right over or immediately pitch into the garbage. One is green, understated, wise, the Yoda of plants. The other is fuzzy and a little funny smelling, the fungi that make the world go round. Our friends, moss and mold. And we'll start with producer Taylor Quimby and his 8-year-old assistant producer, Phineas.
I think that mold is our friend, but also it's gross. Also, it's super gross.
Maybe you've grabbed a loaf of bread, hoping to make PB&J, only to find a green carpet growing inside the bag. Or dug into a carton of strawberries, felt something squishy and soft between your fingers, and looked down to see a sunken berry covered in strands of white fuzz. You may have reacted something like this.
Look at that.
Oh. That's really gross.
Yes, mold can be gross. But when you think about it, mold is also pretty awesome.
Mold is a what? Mold is a term that we use to describe fungi that are microscopic throughout their lives.
This is Nick Money. No, he is not a professional wrestler or reality TV celebrity, and yes, that is his real name. He's a professor at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio.
I've studied mushroom biology or fungal biology for many years, so I'm a mycologist.
If you've ever seen a mushroom poking out from the forest floor, what you should know is that what you are seeing is only the tip of the fungal iceberg.
Most of the time, that organism exists in the form of these very thin threads, about 10 times thinner than a human hair. And that's the feeding colony of the fungus.
That fruit body is the mushroom we see in the woods. Mold is slightly different. It's an iceberg without a tip. Mold is a fungus that does make something like a mushroom, but that mushroom is also just too small to see. And strangely enough, you actually have more in common with that iceberg than you do with the plants and the trees that you see outside.
In an evolutionary sense and a genetic sense, fungi are much more closely related to animals, including ourselves, than they are to plants.
Plants soak up sunlight and make their own food for themselves inside their own cells.
Whereas fungi actually break down materials produced by other organisms.
Sort of like us.
We call them decomposers.
Mold is the hungry friend who's always ready to finish your leftovers so they don't go to waste.
You're gonna eat that? That looks real good.
Mold and other fungi also serve our ecosystems by breaking down all the dead stuff. Without fungi, all those fallen tree trunks and dead leaves that clutter up the forest floor would pile up and up and up, choking out forest life as we know it. But have you ever wondered, how did a microscopic fungus you associate with the forest get onto your food? Well, it didn't really have to travel at all. It was with you the whole time.
Almost every breath that we take, and I say this from first breath to last gasp, we were actually inhaling fungal spores.
If you want to know just how intertwined you and mold really are, there's an easy at-home experiment you can try. There are lots of variations online, but here's the gist. Get a bag of bread, take out one slice, and using your unwashed, normal, everyday at-home hands,
rub your hands all over that piece of bread. Get it in your elbow pit. Yeah, there we go. Okay, all right, good. All right, so now open that bag.
Afterwards, place the piece of bread in a plastic Ziploc bag with a little air in there, maybe a little bit of water, and label it with a marker, dirty hands. Then give your hands a thorough Corona-level hand washing.
What's your go-to hand washing song?
I just can't do like 30 minutes. I mean 30 seconds. 30 minutes.
Next, rub your now clean hands over another slice of bread, just like you did the first time.
Okay, so let's put that in bag numero dos.
Label that one clean hands. Finally, tape the bags somewhere out of the way. And then you just wait.
Day one, still no bold on the bread. Sadly.
Day two, no mold.
Mic check.
Blah.
Okay, it's working. So it's day...
something, something.
Yeah, I don't know what day it is. I lost track. So let's see what we got.
Clean hands, a little mold. A little bit of mold on, like, the side of it.
What about dirty hands?
Dirty hands, a lot of mold, mostly mold, like, all over, like, the whole thing.
Ugh. Lots of little spots.
Yeah.
What color is it?
Blue.
Blue? I would call that green. Gosh, am I calling
actually,
it? I mean, look, it, like, totally matches, like, the wall.
It's, like, tealish white.
Scientists think there are millions of species of fungi, and there are thousands of known species of mold. Nick Money says there's a couple you might even have heard of.
Aspergillus is a very common kind of mold that will grow on food material. Penicillium is another one.
And yes, that is in fact the very mold used to discover and make the antibiotic penicillin. Nick says that a lot of these household molds are harmless, meaning cutting a bit of mold off a piece of food and eating the rest of it is a pretty safe choice.
However, there's a subset of people for whom mold exposure is more of a problem.
These are the mold problems you might have heard about. Houses that weren't built properly and so never fully dry out and have mold basically growing all through the walls, or places that get flooded or have some other kind of severe water damage that was never dealt with. Too much mold can trigger allergies. Sometimes there can be so many spores floating around indoors that you can actually start to see them, like dust.
So in those kind of situations, there can be so many spores that they can actually provoke an asthma attack. So for anybody that suffers from asthma, exposure to large numbers of these spores is very, very problematic. And asthma, of course, can be a very serious and even life-threatening condition.
The scariest of these bad mold situations or when you get molds that actually produce a kind of fungal poison called a mycotoxin. But remember, every breath you take is full of mold spores. As long as there isn't too much, it's mostly harmless. And the same is true of our moldy bread. Just a colony of happy decomposers filling up a plastic baggie.
Does it gross you out to think about the fact that there's like fungus on your hands all the time?
Well, before I eat and after I eat, I think I should always wash my hands.
That's a good idea for a lot of reasons. There are other germs you don't really want on your hands, and can't see those either. But let me just say, if the idea of eating mold freaks you out, well, let me introduce you to one of my very favorite foods, cheese.
So I have in front of me
yes.
a Cambozola
okay.
black label. So this has a rind. Gosh, if I had to describe it, I would say it's almost like the color of elephant skin.
It's gray.
Yes, yeah.
Is it a little bit furry?
I don't know that I would totally call it furry, but it does
it
have...
It may have been. It may have been furry once before it was squished down and put in plastic. So I think it's a mixture of mucor and certainly penicillium, which is the blue mold.
This is Sister Noella Marcelino, who has my favorite combination of qualifications for this episode. She is an artisanal cheesemaker, a fungi-focused microbiologist, and a Benedictine nun.
Throughout the centuries, monasteries were centers of culture, crossroads of civilization. Many of these cheeses began in monasteries, like cheddar. Munster means comes from Monasterio?
A lot of cheeses are made in a cave or cellar. Well, not made really, but aged, ripened.
Well, you know, when you taste a cheese that's supposed to be ripened, when you taste that when it's only a few days old, it's going to be have a horrible taste. It's going to taste rubbery. It will have no flavor.
And the reason these tasteless, rubbery cheeses are placed in a cave is so that they can be closer to the earth, to the living wonder that is our soil.
Because that's where these microorganisms naturally live. They say that within a gram of soil, there's more diversity than in the rainforest.
These are the same types of fungal spores that wind up on your bread or the rotting tomato that cheesemakers encourage to colonize their cheese. The threads of the mold snake through it, breaking down, eating cheesy proteins, and literally creating the flavors that many people have come to know and love as a byproduct.
And I'm wondering, if I take a little taste of this?
Mm-hmm.
I've got a cracker, of course.
Okay.
So when I try this cheese, I mean, what should I be thinking about in terms of the flavor and the complexity and what the mold brings? What should I be tasting for?
Well, I think, first of all, it's nice to smell it, too. If you're into smelling cheese. And what I would say is one thing you're going to notice, because that must have been aged in a cave, is an earthy smell. Does earthiness come to mind?
Yeah.
The French would call that smell. It's like the champignon de Paris. It is like the mushrooms of Paris. So for some people, the smell of earth, and you could say degradation, is attractive. And, it, you know, that's part of eating cheese. I mean, we are definitely eating breakdown products.
And the mold does something else, too. It coats the cheese in a loving, furry embrace, protecting it from other things that could contaminate it and make it inedible.
In a cheese, like, I don't know if you've ever had a Tome de Savoie or a Saint-Nectaire, there are a whole class of cheeses that would have kind of this gray coat on them.
Yes, she is talking about the rind, that hard crust that some cheeses have. And you may have wondered, is this edible? You can eat it, though the squeamish might not want to after hearing this.
If you were to look at that cheese at about 48 hours in the cave, you would see little hairs that are white, sort of gray. And at the end of every hair is a round ball. If you look under a microscope, that's called a sporangium. Mucor would have thousands of those hairs with a little ball on top. And what happens is there are spores on the surface of that ball and they break off. And then eventually the cheese is covered with a gray coat. So you just have to think that, you know, what's going on a rind, it's alive.
When a cheese becomes famous, the flavor people have fallen in love with is the flavor of a specific mold or combination of molds and the way that cheesemakers almost shepherd it onto their cheese. Sister Noella has a friend, Jim, who calls himself a cheese philosopher.
He says, you know, people are fine talking about wine and, you know, flowery images and fruity. But he said, do they really want to talk about what cheese reminds them of? Like locker rooms or smelly socks?
Or death. Mold and fungi are decomposers. They come for foods when it gets old. They break down trees and plants when they've fallen in the woods. And they come for us when we die too.
I think in general, we tend to not want to look at degradation. Certainly we don't want to look at death. It's frightening. I have found as a cheesemaker, I've thought about it often and for a long time, that actually we are eating a degradation product and it's actually delicious. So I feel it's a sort of an unconscious way to prepare you for the end of a cycle.
If you don't eat it, it'll get moldy.
Yep, eventually, that's what happens.
they're always with us throughout our lives. They're in us, they're on us. Yes, there's a certain Zen-like sense in which we can accept that interaction with the microscopic world. And yeah, there's something beautiful about that, absolutely.
Nick Money, Sister Noella, and I agree. Perhaps there is a little magic or grace in even the fuzziest, stinkiest mold.
That's mucor.
Yeah.
Isn't that gorgeous?
It's amazing.
You know, people might say, well, why, as you, as a Benedictine nun, why are you studying science and not theology? But I see God in that. You know, I look at that creation and with wonder.
You should still toss out your moldy bread, though. Gross.
Too gross.
All right, bye, mold.
Bye, mold.
You're listening to Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. And now, executive producer Erica Janik on an organism celebrated in the Japanese national anthem. That's just a fun fact that we aren't going to elaborate on in any way. Here's Erica.
So here's a bit about me. I am an enthusiastic but largely unknowledgeable moss lover. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, a very mossy place. Got engaged near the Hall of Mosses in Olympic National Park. My phone is filled with close-up glamour shots of moss. I just love the bright green color and the textures. So I decided that now is the time, when we're all sticking closer to home, to get to know my local mosses. And the first thing I learned is that apparently there's one thing to clear up right away.
So when my mother tells people that I study moss, their first response to her is always, oh, she studies that fuzzy stuff on bread. Oh, that's mold. That's a fungus.
This is Dr. Jessica Budke, a professor at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville who studies mosses. So number one, moss isn't mold. I don't know who needs to hear this, but please stop calling moss mold. Okay, there is one reason you might legitimately confuse moss and mold, which we will get to later, but that is barely an excuse. In fact, besides apparently being confused with mold, there are a lot of things we call moss that aren't moss at all. Spanish moss? Not moss. It's actually in the pineapple family. Club mosses? Nope. Those are more closely related to ferns. Moss pink and moss phlox, which are pink flowers that are definitely not mosses. Carrageenan moss? No. Not a moss. It's a red algae, often used as a thickener in food. And just to confuse things more, the features that make moss moss are also just a list of things they don't have.
They don't have seeds. They don't have fruits. They don't have flowers. They don't have vasculature, so internal cells that are piping and moving water around inside of them.
So what are mosses?
So mosses are very small green plants. So they're photosynthetic. So they use air, water, and sunlight, and they make their own food. So that's one of the big things that distinguishes them from mold. Mold has to eat other things. Mosses can feed themselves.
Mosses are tiny, simple plants. In fact, mosses are some of the very simplest plants on Earth. They have no roots or stems or any internal structure to hold them up. In fancy science language, mosses are bryophytes.
The bryophytes are 450 million years old. That's 50 million years before there was a fern or any other plant on our planet.
This is Annie Martin, better known as Moss and Annie. She's a self-taught moss specialist in North Carolina. She runs a mossery, a moss nursery, writes and teaches about moss, rescues moss in danger of being killed.
It hurt my heart, so I started rescuing them.
She's basically the best friend a moss could ever have. Mosses can't grow very tall. Ecologist Robin Kimmerer has written that at the scale of a moss, walking through the woods as a 6-foot human is a lot like flying over the continent at 32,000 feet. You can see that it's there, but like the view from a plane, the details, the life gets lost. Which means the best way to appreciate moss is to get down to their level get onto the ground.
In order to notice them, you really have to zoom in, right? You have to sort of get down on your hands and knees and get your face really close to the ground. Once you zoom in, you really see that it's this entire miniature world, right? It's like this miniature forest.
But being small and simple hasn't stopped them. Mosses inhabit nearly every ecosystem on Earth. Mosses are opportunists. If you ask moss to describe its dream home, it would likely say cool, dark, wet. Places where other plants really struggle. And because they don't have roots, they can't dig very deep to find moisture and even pull some water right out of the air. But that said, there are mosses that have adapted to drier climates. Mosses grow on trees, sidewalks, gardens, roofs, even poop.
They're called dung mosses. You have to go to far northern Alaska or far southern Chile in order to see them. And they're really neat because not only do they grow on poop, which is cool in and of itself, but besides that, their capsules make odors that smell like poop that attract the flies, and the flies get their sticky spores stuck to them and then take the spores to the next piece of poop. And so each place you find this moss is basically a place where a pile of poop used to be. And they so smell like poop. It's really neat, right? Like a plant that's made poop smells to trick a fly into moving it around on the landscape. So it can get, like, how do you get from poop to poop as a moss? You trick a fly.
So there it is. The one reason you may be forgiven for confusing moss and mold. Did you miss it? Because mosses don't have seeds, they, just like mold, reproduce via spores. Mostly, mosses rely on the wind to carry their spores around, but sphagnum moss has evolved this little capsule, which explode, shooting the spores into the air at 36,000 times the force of gravity. I'd like to see a mold do that. So really, mosses will grow anywhere that has moisture and nutrients, or where it can trick flies. And jumping on that sometimes bouncy moss is actually beneficial, Annie assured me.
So you're saying it's okay to do that?
It's advisable to do that.
Oh, great.
That helps the plant fragments or the rhizoids of a colony to attach to the soil or whatever substrate. But you can sit on it, you can lay down on it.
Now, this isn't true of all mosses. Some are very fragile, but there's a whole group of mosses that can be walked on, the kinds that many people plant instead of grass in their yards. Many of us are growing moss by accident, a patch between the bricks on a front walk, a sliver between the shingles on our roofs, a fertile field under the downspout behind the garage. But purposefully growing moss, that's a different story. So a few weeks ago, I tried to grow my own moss on a log using some instructions that I found on the internet. The recipe called for 1.5 cups of moss, so I went out in my yard to find some. Walking around my yard right now, I have several patches of moss here. Some growing around my plants, but I think I'm gonna take the moss from the back of my house. Then I mix that with 2 cups of yogurt. I've seen some recipes that say that you should put it in a blender. I'm just mixing it by hand in this big bowl. I'm not sure what the right thing to do is, but hopefully this works. We'll find out, hopefully in a couple weeks. And I slathered it on a log. Do you know what happened to that batch?
Norman,
that first
no.
batch.
No!
Well, it turns out that moss mixed into a slurry with yogurt is irresistible to dogs. Mine ate the whole first batch. So I mixed another one and hid the log in a different part of the yard. But both Annie and Jessica said I probably shouldn't have done this at all.
It yields very inconsistent results, and so I consider it a haphazard method. Why waste your blender, and how many blenders would it take to fill up a yard?
So trying to get mosses to grow places they aren't already growing is really hard.
If you really want more mosses in your life, it might take a while, because you have to try to replicate the types of places and conditions that mosses already like to grow. Annie had a different recommendation for growing moss, one that doesn't involve blenders or buttermilk.
And you can make your own moss dish garden, which would be in an open container, or you can use a jar or some type of a glass container to create a terrarium. And it's fun for all ages. I must say that the older you are, you may even get more excited than the little kids.
The place to start your dish garden is with harvesting mosses growing in your area. But rather than just growing mosses, you might just want to get to know it. This might be tricky, as there are as many as 13,000 species of moss, and most don't have common names.
Plants aren't like the bird community. The bird community has official common names for all the birds. We don't have official common names for all the mosses, but that just means you can make up your own common names and decide what you want to call them.
There are some really good visual guides to help you tell your new green friends apart. You can find them on Annie's website, Moss Mountain, and in the perfectly named A Visit to the Miniature Forest that Jessica helped write. Jessica had some tips for getting to know mosses. First, it helps to see where the moss is growing. Many mosses prefer a particular surface, like rocks or the base of trees.
Some mosses are very substrate specific, so they're only growing on the sides of trees, or they're only growing on a tree branch, or they're only growing on rocks, or they're only growing on soils.
Then, how is it growing? Upright or sprawling?
So one of the growth forms has mosses that are upright, that are often in little cushions, and that don't branch very much, versus the other kind of mosses, which are sprawling and lay flat and sort of grow along their substrate. So they often look like little ferns or little feathers, and they just have tons and tons of branches.
Because there are so many different species, Jessica thinks it's best to start one level up from the individuals, at the group or genus level.
The easiest ones to start with are the big ones. So mostly there's one called the hairy capped moss, and it's Polytrichum communi. And it's probably, like, if you put your fingers out, it's like 2 inches tall or so, which is pretty big for a moss. It looks from the top very much like a star shape. When you hold the leaves up to the light, you can't see through them. And they have these really pointy leaves, dark green, star-shaped. And then that little capsule that they have, the common name comes from the fact that it has a little cap of tissue on the capsule that's hairy. And so you can literally pull off the little hairy cap to help you sort of know that you found the hairy cap moss. That's a really good one. The other one people usually know a lot is called the pincushion moss. It's in the genus Leucobrinum. And so it's also called the white moss. But they look like little pincushions. They're a minty green colored moss that grows in these cute little tufts that you can poke. And you definitely should poke moss and pet them. Like, petting moss is great.
Mosses also make really great neighbors, especially if you like your neighbors unobtrusive, quietly letting you know when things are wrong.
Well, so mosses don't have roots, so they don't mine the soil for water. Almost all the water they get comes from rainwater. And so they're getting unfiltered rainwater that they're absorbing into their bodies, which means that they're highly impacted by what's happening in rainwater. So if there's changes in the pH of the rainwater, there's too much pollution in the rainwater. So mosses can tell us a lot about pollution and water quality.
Armed with my new moss identification tools, I went to visit one of my favorite expanses of moss, a patch I now know is studded with pincushion mosses.
And then I also like to think about it as making friends, right? You're like going out and like meeting a bunch of new friends and a bunch of new mosses. And then the next time you're out on your walk, it's like, hey, what's up? How you doing, Polytrichum? How you doing, Hypnum? And you could sort of say hi to them as you're like out there in the field, checking them out again.
That was our executive producer, Erica Janik. Outside In will be back after a break. You're listening to Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Lilacs are New Hampshire's state flower. And this week, in some parts of the state, they are in their full, fragrant glory. So it's the perfect time to revisit this next story, a tale of love and pride, which originally aired on NHPR last May. Here's our flower correspondent, Justine Paradise.
I have always loved getting a bouquet of lilacs. I have a specific vase. I always put the bouquet in every year when they bloom. I don't know, I've just always loved them, and they grow well here.
This is Elise Sullivan. She's a photographer living in Durham, New Hampshire. She and her 15-year-old son, Dion, are the winners of last year's statewide competition for lilac photos.
When we started looking for lilacs, initially he couldn't identify a rhododendron from a lilac, like they were just purple flowered things.
But he got good. In the winning photo, Dion is leaning into the leaves, totally surrounded by purple blossoms.
And he's got his eyes closed and he's sniffing, and I soften the picture a little bit to give kind of a feeling of being in amongst the smell of the flowers.
Our story today starts with a question from a listener, Mary Colvard in Nottingham.
Well, my question was, why are Rochester, New Hampshire and Rochester, New York both labeled the Lilac City?
Mary's question about Lilac City seems relatively simple, one that might lead into a sweet story about a beloved flower. But as it turns out, the tale of the lilac in New Hampshire is one of identity, of pride, and even of hubris. The fragrance of the lilac is powerful, even intoxicating. With its heart-shaped leaves and flowers that grow in long, cornucopia-like spires, the lilac's a charismatic plant, and it's New Hampshire's state flower. Although that is a little peculiar, because although it is a common favorite, it's not like it grows wild in New Hampshire's woods or anything. It's an ornamental, a garden plant, and native to the Balkans. And in 1919, the purple lilac beat out 9 other contenders for the title, including popular and familiar New England wildflowers like the wood lily, purple aster, and goldenrod. Ultimately, the lilac even triumphed in a final stalemate with the also introduced apple blossom.
Took a lot of controversy to get there, but they got there in 1919 and it was voted in.
That's Guy Ginta. He's the former landscape specialist for the Department of Transportation and now the chairman of the Governor's Lilac and Wildflower Commission.
It was formed to help promote the growth of lilacs and to educate the public on how to care for lilacs.
This is also the commission that runs the Lilac Photo Contest. As its name suggests, the commission is particularly devoted to lilacs. It almost sounds like the name places all flowers into 2 categories, lilacs and pretenders. So Guy is literally the lilac guy.
You notice the color of my phone is purple. I'm considered a lilac nut. As you probably saw my car coming in, I have lilacs on 2 cars. I have the word lilac and lilacs. But then I have an antique car, and I was able to get lilac on that because it's antique and it's different from your regular registration. So I still have 3 plates with lilacs on them.
Yeah. Guy has not 1, not 2, but 3 vanity plates printed with some form of the word lilac. So again, Guy chairs the Governor's Lilac and Wildflower Commission, and that's a group that's over 30 years old.
Governor's Lilac Commission was formed in 1984 by the father, John Sununu. And it was formed along with the help of Mel Thompson, who back then was very much into lilacs. And they were, the word was back then is to purpleize New Hampshire's highways. That was what the hope would be. They just loved lilacs.
I'm interested in why lilacs, though, because they're not native, right?
That's right. They're not native. I believe they were from Eastern Europe and portions of Asia when they first were developed. But they came here in 1750 at the Governor's Wentworth Coolidge Mansion, which we believe is the first place in the nation that had lilacs. Now, there's a place in Michigan who tries to say that they had them before us. We have records that prove we have them since 1750. They don't have quite those records, we believe. And I can't imagine them coming across from Europe, landing in New Hampshire, and then bringing them over to Michigan. I'm sure we're the first ones with lilacs.
According to Guy and the commission, before Michigan, before Thomas Jefferson, before George Washington at Mount Vernon, before even the Declaration of Independence, New Hampshire had lilacs. But New Hampshire's Rochester might not have been first to the title of Lilac City. To respond to Mary's question about why Rochester, New York and Rochester, New Hampshire are both called Lilac City, the short answer is no one knows.
But if you can figure it out, a lot of people would be happy over here.
This is Blaine Cox, Rochester, New Hampshire's city manager. Blaine keeps a running collection of newspaper clippings on this question, some of which date back to the 1950s, but none of which provide a definitive answer.
So there are 2 theories. One is that Helen Husley Champlin, who lived in the city many years ago, I want to say she passed sometime in the 1970s, But she was an active gardener. But she was the one behind getting the purple lilac named as the state of New Hampshire flower.
Like back in 1919?
It was very early.
Wow.
But there's no indication in any of the records that she was responsible for Rochester being named the Lilac City. Whether it was just a coincidence that she lived here and was active in getting it designated as the state flower is not known.
I also spoke to a historian, Catherine Grover, who wrote a history of the city, and she thinks this is the right theory. Helen and her husband also founded the Haven Hill Garden Club and imported dozens of lilacs from England. Helen might have petitioned the state to christen Rochester Lilac City in the 1930s, but the city clerk has no record of this.
So the other theory is that a sports writer from East Rochester named Reggie Hurd came up with the name back in the 1950s. And nobody's been able to confirm that, but a couple folks said, yeah, could have. So it's a mystery to be solved.
But there is also a third theory, presented here by Guy Junta.
The story that I know, and I can't say I'm completely 100% accurate on this, but I believe it was in 1975, after years and years of realizing Rochester, New York, was such famous for its lilacs, and Rochester, New Hampshire, had a lot of lilacs in its vicinity, decided, listen, why don't we make this also Lilac City, Rochester, New Hampshire? And I think it helped to boost their economy and help beautify the city better. And that's why I believe they named it the Rochester, the New Hampshire Lilac City. Plus the fact that we are a state flower too. Why would it not be Rochester, the Lilac City?
Fascinating. So it was not a coincidence.
I don't believe so. Oh no, I don't believe so at all.
You know what's so funny about New Hampshire, because I'm not from New Hampshire, is I often find that there's, you know, this first in the nation mentality, and you know, we've got to like, there's kind of a competitive edge that New Hampshire has in its spirit, you know?
Yes, that's true. And I think I related to it earlier, this, the lilac is such a strong plant. In fact, some of the best years I've seen lilac bloom have been in some of the coldest winters we've had. So there it is. That's the New Hampshire connection right there. It's a hardy, strong plant and has so many different colors and so many different varieties. It's all New Hampshire.
In a sense, lilacs are a symbol of Granite State pride. Pride that led Rochester to officially claim the title of Lilac City, whether that was in the 30s, 50s, or even in the 1970s, perhaps in response to competition from the likes of New York. It's also pride that led governors to purpleize state highways, and pride that compels gardeners to plant lilacs in their backyards. But as written in the Book of Proverbs, and as written by Jay-Z, pride always goeth before the fall.
This is the house. It's the mansion house.
It's a beautiful kind of sunflower yellow, and it's overlooking the harbor.
Originally, it was red. The Coolidge just painted it yellow.
This is Sandy Phelps. She's the lead guide at the Wentworth Coolidge Mansion, which was the governor's house on a windy peninsula overlooking the water.
This is the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. The Piscataqua River runs up in through here. This is Newcastle Island, straight across. The property also owns Leech's Island over here and an island snuffbox and clam pit, which are over in there. One of them sort of hidden, and another one is in front of us.
Snuffbox and clam pit. That's great names. This is the place where Governor Wentworth planted lilacs in 1750. Later, the house passed on to the Coolidge family. They were friendly with Beatrix Potter, and they painted the house that eye-catching yellow. You can imagine how the purple lilacs planted by the house would really pop against that sunflower wall. That is, if there were any lilacs left by that sunflower wall.
The lilacs, you can see on that postcard, originally absolutely covered this whole area, and you can sort of see what's begun to happen to them. There's a disease that's in the soil called emilaria that's getting into the lilacs and slowly killing them off. The reason they haven't replanted next to the house is they're afraid it's still there.
What is happening to them?
They are beginning to just shrivel up and die, and you can see there's some, it looks like driftwood down there, you see right by the wall, and that's part of an old trunk from the lilacs. That's how big they were.
What the problem was is the plants were so old. And I mean, there were trees, there were lilac stems that looked like tree trunks. They were 2 feet wide.
This is Lilac Guy, Guy Ginta again.
And the problem was is some of us wanted to start pruning to hope we could rejuvenate these plants, while others were saying it's historical and we shouldn't touch it. Well, we held on and held on until the historical part of it started to wear off because of the plants were dying.
Not pruning the lilacs isn't good for them, according to Beth Simpson of Rolling Green Nursery in Greenland, New Hampshire.
They need to be renovated by pruning all the, you know, frequently. And I think that I know in the nursery, you know, after a while, it's good to prune out about 30% of the old wood of lilacs and to keep them healthy.
The caretakers of these old lilacs wanted the lilacs to look old, because of, you know, New Hampshire's first in the nation identity, which can make everything into a competition. So in keeping up appearances of this idea of being the first and oldest, the lilacs weren't properly cared for. And with that, plus the cumulative effects of years of drought, they got sick. By the time anyone realized what was happening, their ancient roots had been infected with honey fungus, or armillaria. So you could say, from pride comes the fall, and from hubris comes honey fungus. The Wentworth Coolidge Commission decided to try to save the old shrubs with the help of lilac heavyweights like Owen Rogers, an internationally recognized lilac expert and professor at UNH. But alas, it was too late for the old trunks.
You know, they're dead. And unfortunately, that fungus stays in the soil for a very, very long time.
Like how long?
As long as we're probably alive.
But before the old lilacs totally died off, they did come up with a different way to keep that first in the nation distinction.
They worked with Syringa Plus, which was out of Newbury, Massachusetts, and they were a lilac specialty grower, to have some of the original lilacs tissue cultured, which means cloned, essentially.
Cloning. In this effort, the commission produced hundreds of plants cloned from the ancient lilac trunks. Beth helped pot up the specimens and built new raised beds to plant them in. The commission also sold some of these clones to the public at the Lilac Festival. Beth says her part of the project took about 8 years, and last fall, they transplanted some of the mature clones to a new bed with a mix of other varieties.
With some TLC going forward, you know, a little extra water if we have a droughty time, or maybe some fertilizer, we should start seeing flowers in the next few years in the new planting, which would be great.
So you're hopeful?
Oh, yeah, I'm very hopeful.
And as far as the question of the title of Lilac City, I made over a dozen phone calls to various city officials and organizations in Rochester, and no one I spoke to knew for sure how or why or even when the city got that name. New Hampshire's lilacs might have been the oldest in the nation, or they might not have, but the point is they're a symbol of something. The name might have come from enterprising gardener Helen Hussey Champlin and her garden club in the 1930s. New Hampshire might have been competing with Rochester, New York. But perhaps this is all just an endearing coincidence, something to laugh about. So even though the honey fungus did kill the old trunks, their tissue-cultured clones endure, and so does the legend of the lilacs. For Guy Ginta, this is the stuff of song.
There's a place I know where the purple lilacs grow.
Now you know why I like it. You want to play the whole thing?
Sure.
I used to love this when I moved to New Hampshire. I really just used to love it. And now I play it. I have a jukebox, and in the jukebox is this record. Oh, New Hampshire. New Hampshire is where I want to be. I loved it. Oh, New Hampshire. I love New Hampshire, naturally. I won't bore you any more with that singing.
I love that.
Producer Justine Paradise. The story of the lilac in New Hampshire originally aired on NHPR in 2019. Up next on Outside In. This month, Taylor Quimby, who also hosts our spin-off podcast, Patient Zero, has been bringing us Tick Season, straightforward advice on tick-borne disease. Today, in the final installment of the series, diagnosing tick-borne disease during a coronavirus pandemic and how COVID-19 may influence research and exposure to illnesses like Lyme disease.
You may have heard that the symptoms of Lyme disease are all over the place. Joint pain, meningitis, facial paralysis. It's true that Lyme can present in a lot of different ways, and there are many possible symptoms if Lyme disease goes untreated. But early on, a lot of people with Lyme do experience something similar. Flu-like symptoms, a fever, aches and pains, and a funny rash that's sometimes colored like the bullseye of a dartboard. Sometimes, but not always.
It often doesn't look just like a bullseye. It could just be a reddened rash. It could be elongated. It doesn't have to be round.
This is Eric Foster, a medical entomologist with the CDC. If you have any of those symptoms after a tick bite, Eric says, do not hesitate to pick up the phone.
See your healthcare provider immediately.
Of course, not everybody wants to see the doctor in person these days, and that's not necessarily a deal breaker. Tim Leahy is an infectious disease doctor at the University of Vermont Medical Center.
A telemedicine visit could be a great way to get your initial evaluation for Lyme disease, and that may be all that you need.
Hospitals and urgent care facilities all across the country have been ramping up efforts to conduct medicine via screens. And if you've got a bullseye rash that can be seen by webcam and a history of exposure to ticks, that's enough clinical evidence for a Lyme disease diagnosis. The doctor can send a prescription for antibiotics to your local pharmacy, and you can start treatment. Of course,
Lyme can do lots of things, though, and it can be a diagnostic puzzle.
Many people who acquire a tick-borne disease don't ever remember being bitten by a black-legged tick. Eric Foster says that here in New Hampshire, where Lyme is endemic, summertime symptoms like fever, rash, and body aches could all be indicative of Lyme disease.
Or, you know, it might not be Lyme. It could be another tick-borne disease such as anaplasmosis or ehrlichiosis or babesiosis. You know, there's a lot of similarities in the early symptoms in these diseases, and it's just always best to kind of, you know, be cognizant of that and go see your healthcare provider or talk to your healthcare provider.
The thing is, some of those symptoms are similar to another disease that's on all of our minds right now.
Yes. Hello, Taylor. My name is Paul Auerter.
Dr. Paul Auerter is clinical director for infectious diseases at Johns Hopkins and former president of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. He says that one of the challenges doctors will have this summer is that people with a flu-like illness may think they have the coronavirus.
People will be concerned that coronavirus is more frequent. So you go to the more frequent diagnosis first. This is very normal.
There is one symptom, he says, aside from the bullseye rash, though, that can help distinguish between Lyme and COVID-19.
Lyme disease does a lot of things, but it does not affect the lungs. You wouldn't have a cough.
Nevertheless, both diseases can present in subtle ways. Both Dr. Leahy and Dr. Auerter agree that there's enough overlap. Some Lyme disease cases will likely get missed this summer in the rush to rule out coronavirus.
Doctors and patients alike have COVID on the brain, and that's appropriate, and we should be doing testing for COVID in people who have a fever. The challenge is to make sure that we're all thinking farther down the list of possibilities.
And with so many folks hiking local trails, starting gardens, and playing outside, tick-borne disease is a possibility. Maria Duke-Wasser is a disease ecologist at Columbia University.
I think people will probably be more exposed, but we don't know for sure. So that's something we want to study.
Unfortunately, the coronavirus pandemic has delayed or halted research into tick and tick-borne illnesses, even at top institutions like Johns Hopkins, where Dr. Auerter works.
My research has been suspended this spring, and you know, high time for studying Lyme disease is typically April through July.
And at Columbia University.
So that's the worst scenario where there's more people sick and we don't know about it or we can't really measure it.
That was producer Taylor Quimby. Outside In was produced this week by Taylor Quimby, Phineas Quimby, Erica Janik, Justine Paradise, and me, Sam Evans-Brown. Special thanks to Mawson Annie Martin, author of The Magical World of Moss Gardening, and Dr. Jessica Budke. Also thanks to Benjamin Wolf, Megan Biango-Daniels, Patrick Pawlowski, Catherine Grover, and Evie King at Syringa Plus. Maureen McMurray is the director of Painting Roses Red. If you'd like even more Outside In, we have more to give you. Please sign up for our newsletter. You can find the link at our website, outsideinradio.org. Music in this episode from Uncle Bibby, Polish Ambassador Kevin MacLeod, and Blue Dot Sessions. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.